Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
I'm so excited to tell you a bit about today's sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, Music Masters Collective hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available, but spots are extremely limited, so visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/inside to learn more.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi. Thanks so much for tuning in. In today's episode, I'm going to talk about what I consider to be the bluegrass event of the decade, What the Night Brings, the Jeff Austin tribute that recently went down in Denver, and its significance in understanding the progression of bluegrass and acoustic music, and also understanding just what that scene is really all about today, as well as the implications of the fact that that event took place out here in Denver, Colorado. After that, I'll share a few words with up-and-coming jamgrass band, my good friends The Kitchen Dwellers, and then we'll get on to a full-length interview with modern acoustic guitar virtuoso John Stickley. So, tons to get to today, but before we get rolling, I just want to remind you guys that Inside the Musician's Brain is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network. And if you guys dig what you're hearing here, you should definitely check out Osiris, the network of music and culture podcasts with all kinds of great content, great shows, great hosts. And their latest release is called After Midnight. It's a retrospective on Phish's Big Cypress Festival at the turn of the century. I just checked out episode one, and what an incredible story. The band played from 11 p.m. until sunrise. And let me tell you, the last time I played an 8-hour gig, oh, right, I never have, and I probably never will, because that is insane. Just an incredible thing to do for their fans, an incredible feat of stamina, and, of course, an incredible story. It's hosted by Jesse Jarnow. The first two episodes are up, and there's great interviews with Trey and Fishman as well, but I especially love hearing the interview with John Peluska, their manager, and he talks about how they created the whole ethos and community around fish and how they sort of fostered and preserved it over the years, which is sort of what they're known for, and then how the Big Cypress Festival came to be. It's truly an astounding story. So check it out. It's a great listen, After Midnight. All right, in the last episode of the podcast, not sure if you guys checked it out, but I went over a history of bluegrass music from its traditional roots in the 1940s through many different phases of evolution leading into the 1990s when you started to see the advent of the jamgrass scene with bands like Salmon, Cheese, and the Yonder Mountain String Band, and then everything that's happened over the last 20 years as that scene has just completely blown up. And this past summer, we lost a real icon of that music world, a hugely influential musician who we were lucky to collaborate with many times. He touched many lives and was an absolute integral part, and I would say sort of founding architect of the modern acoustic scene that's thriving today, and that's Jeff Austin of the Yonder Mountain String Band. And What the Night Brings was a tribute to Jeff and a fundraiser for his family. And I would say it was the most profound night of music that I think I've really ever been a part of. It was so incredible to behold roughly 7,000 fans who traveled from all over the place to be a part of one night of music. And I really felt like I had to give this momentous occasion some coverage here on the podcast. To me, this was the seminal bluegrass event of the modern era for two reasons. First reason is the unreal lineup of bands, a cross-section of the jamgrass world featuring really all the prominent players who are out there playing modern variations of bluegrass and presenting it in the style that we first observed in bands like the Yonder Mountain String Band. And the second reason, maybe even more significant, is the way that this event had on full display the community that's evolved around this music since so many more bands and fans have come in the door to be a part of it. Now, as far as the bands go, this was really unlike anything I've ever seen in a one-day event, you know, excluding festival lineups. As far as what bands were represented, you had String Cheese, Salmon, the infamous String Dusters, Sambush, Green Sky, Railroad, Yonder, Keller, the Traveling McCurries, Hot Rise, Billy Strings. I mean, the list goes on and on. And if you're ever wondering what modern bluegrass has evolved into, from songwriting styles to modern interpretations of playing the instruments to effects pedals, modern sound, lights, production, all of that stuff was on display in a really definitive way at What the Night Brings. So that's kind of the musical component. But again, this event was so much more than a lineup of bands and what they represent as far as a progression of a musical style. To me, What the Night Brings really symbolized the community that bluegrass music has become. It was about all those bands that make up that scene, supporting each other, collaborating with each other endlessly, and also about the fans and how they support the artists that they follow, and also about how they love and support each other. And as I was taking this whole event in and just observing what it meant to the musicians and the energy that this incredible room of fans was putting forth, I was just so blown away by that community factor and what we're capable of as one big extended family of bands and fans together. And there it was on full display, this thing that Yonder and Jeff created, circling back around to pick him up, celebrate his life, support his family, and truly something I think if you were in that room that night, this was an evening of music that you will never forget. The jamgrass scene and everything that it's become, I think, was more fully on display at that moment in time than anything that I've previously observed. And I don't necessarily know what it's like in other genres of music, but surely this community factor is something that makes bluegrass unique. And here we are on this definitive night for the music, and that's what it's really all about. We're there to support our brother Jeff and to support each other and celebrate his life. And I want to take a second to send my love to Jeff and to all of his family and friends and to his many musical comrades. And I'll say it again, we're so grateful to have collaborated with Jeff so much over the years, to have spent so much time with him, and just to have learned from him his stagecraft and everything that Yonder, those guys just, they forged the way for everything that came after them. I really can't stress that point enough. Initially, what the Night Brings was supposed to be at the Mission Ballroom, but it sold out so quickly that they moved it to a small arena in Denver, the First Bank Center, and even that sold out in a matter of minutes, which is completely astounding. 7,000 fans. I mean, nothing like this was going on 20 years ago. The scene backstage was surreal. It was like everyone you've ever met in the bluegrass world. So much great camaraderie. I got to hear so many great bands make so much great music that night. We visited with all of our people backstage, and that camaraderie was, oh man, I've never really experienced anything like that. Jamming, reminiscing, remembering Jeff in all the best possible ways. What a fitting send-off. It was a little crazy for us getting out there. We had a show the night before in Connecticut, took the bus overnight to Baltimore, jumped on a 10 a.m. flight to Denver, get to Denver at noon, straight to First Bank. The crew had all the gear, so they had us set up ahead of time. Showed up, sound check at 4, doors at 6. Each band played one or two songs. The Dusters did Rise Sun and the Jeff Classic Cuckoo's Nest. And Andy Hall, Jeremy, and I all sat in with the String Cheese guys. That was great. Yonder Mountain String Band was there that night. They played beautifully. I think they played 3 Jeff songs. I know they played Half Moon Rising. And I was out in front of house listening, and I just had tears in my eyes looking up at the stage and then looking out at the crowd and just seeing what the bluegrass community has evolved into. It's incredible to behold. People, they care about the music and they care about each other, and it's really a beautiful thing to see, and we're so grateful to be a part of it. So we're going to get the Dwellers take on Yonder here in just a second, because they're a band that likely wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Yonder. But there's one thing that I wanted to touch on really quick. Not sure if you guys checked out episode 3, but the intro really covers a history of bluegrass, from the origins of the music to the jamgrass movement of today. And there's one thing that I think I kind of left out in that whole discussion of the evolution of bluegrass, and that's the geographical element of that whole progression and the significance of what the Night Brings being here in Denver. Of course, bluegrass got rolling in the Southeast, and there's still tons of action in Nashville, lots of progressive pickers in addition to the more traditional scene that I would say is anchored in the Southeast. And there's great scenes in New York, Boston, North Carolina. But as the music evolved and bands like Sam and Cheese and Yonder came onto the scene in the 90s, those were all Colorado bands. And the music, as it kind of opened up and evolved, it also migrated west. And then you had everything that was going on in California as well, Olden and the Way, Grisman in the Bay Area playing with Mike Marshall, Daryl Anger, Tony Rice. And of course, you got to give a quick shout out to Hot Rise, one of the original Colorado bluegrass bands. They started out in the 80s and are still going strong today. They play a more traditional strain of the music, but you know that opened a lot of doors for what was to come later. And bluegrass these days, especially the more modern edge of the music, I would say has a strong home base here in Denver. And I also call Denver home, and it's a great place to be. There's tons of musicians, tons of fans, tons of venues, so many great events going on, and it's a really exciting spot to be if you are a bluegrass musician. All right, now for some great perspective on everything that I just got into about Jeff and Yonder, I'm going to roll this short interview that I did with the Kitchen Dwellers, who were recently on tour with us, opening a run of shows over about 2 weeks. They killed it. Crowds were loving their energy, loving their sound. And these guys invited me into the studio to produce their new record, Mirror Maid, which just came out, so make sure to check that out. I love this band for a lot of reasons. They're a true band. They play in a really synergistic style that's more than the sum of the parts, and I always love hearing that. What I also love is the way that these guys approach both the singing and the way that they play their instruments. They're not necessarily from a bluegrass pedigree, though I feel like they've picked up a lot of that vocabulary along the way. But what they do have, and kind of what they've always had in their sound, and something that's very foundational to bluegrass, is just a really solid approach to the playing and the singing. And it's evocative, it rocks a crowd, it really sounds great, and I think that we really captured that on this new record, Mirror Maid. Just listen to what these guys have to say about the influence of Yonder and Jeff, because they're probably one of many bands that have a very similar story, and inspiration probably doesn't get any more direct than this. So here we go, The Kitchen Dwellers. Okay, what's up, guys? We're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and I'm hanging out here with my buds, The Kitchen Dwellers. What's up, guys?
Just hanging out.
Yep.
Hanging out in the bus.
Well, sure glad that we're getting some time with these guys on tour. We're in North Carolina right now, just wrapping up about a two-week run. And I was in the studio with these guys producing their record, Muir Maid, that has just come out. So make sure you give that a listen. We'll talk about that here in a minute. But I really wanted to mostly get your guys' perspective on the influence of Yonder Mountain String Band, and even more specifically, Jeff Austin. We just had really one of the most incredible nights of music that I've ever been a part of, What the Night Brings, out in Denver, just seeing all the bands in our world come together for an incredible cause to support Jeff and his family, and it was just an incredible thing. I know, Torin, that you were there, but I know you guys have an interesting perspective. The Dwellers are a modern-day part of the Jamgrass world, doing some really unique things, making great music, really connecting musically with fans. And, you know, you guys, to me, are a great example of a post-Yonder type string band. And, you know, in some way we are, too, insofar as, you know, they really forged the model, a lot of the things musically and from a business perspective that we're sort of following in our careers. But I wanted to get your guys' perspective, because I know that they've had a huge influence on both of you guys. I'm here with Torin and Sean. And just curious to know, how did Yonder come into your life? How did it look as a fan? You know, you were going to shows, following them around, and then, you know, did that ultimately end up being the thing that inspired you to play and start a band? How was your connection with Yonder? How did that whole thing unfold?
I actually remember like the exact day that I discovered Yonder, and I was in high school, and me and my buddy KW walked into this head shop, record shop in Billings called Ernie November's. I'm pretty sure it's still there. And we walked in, and like we were looking at all this stuff, and Boatman was playing on the speakers. The guy running the shop was playing Boatman on the speakers, and we were like, "What the hell is this?" Like, we had no idea, you know, like no frame of reference what sort of music this was. Like, we were just getting into psychedelic rock, and like,
so there wasn't any string band music on your radar.
Not really. Like, okay. My grandpa listened to bluegrass a lot. He listened to really like the classical, the standards a lot. But I hadn't really ever connected with that as a kid, and I remember like the exact moment when the guy showed us it's the Boatman off of the Mountain Tracks Volume 5. That's what he was listening to that day. And I'm pretty sure he sold us a couple Yonder CDs like right on the spot. We were gonna check it out, and we were both in a band at the time, like, and I was playing drums and stuff, and hadn't ever really picked up a string instrument up until that point, but then sort of like went about teaching myself guitar and mandolin and banjo kind of all at the same time intermittently, sort of as a result of getting more into bluegrass music, which all kind of stemmed from that one day.
And how long was it until you started seeing the band live?
Well, growing up in rural Montana, the music events that, you know, came through were few and far between, and like, I remember we just used to look at like a lot of these shows that people would go see, or bands that people would go see, as like these crazy, unfathomable places that you're like, how do people get to go to that? It like blew my mind when I met someone that had like seen Fish
traveled
live,
to music.
Been to Red Rocks, sure, or been to the Gorge. That blew my mind as like being a country kid in the middle of nowhere in Montana.
Right.
So yeah. So it wasn't until we went to college, and my first Yonder shows was this. There was like this legendary run in 2011 through Montana. When Yonder used to come through and play Montana, like four night runs or something like that at the Wilman. It was like the craziest, gnarliest follow me down to the riverside, like anyone's ever. I've heard Pastor Tim talk about it too, that it was just like the craziest show. And like,
so just legendary insofar as it was this, epic chart topping performances.
Yeah, okay. Two nights of just like ridiculous, crazy psychedelic bluegrass.
Were you there, Swain?
Swain
for
was
that?
There with okay. me. Yeah.
That was
my first Yonder shows,
okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But Swain's from Telluride, so he has a different Yonder story altogether.
That's awesome. I mean, I can't think of a more direct influence than, you know, you heard the tunes, you're captivated, you're influenced. What is this music? You get into the band, you start playing. You know, that's as influential as it gets. So what about you, Swain? What was your intro to the music, and how did it change your life?
Like what Torin just said, I grew up in Telluride, Colorado, where they have the, you know, the Telluride Bluegrass Fest. And my dad actually worked in the ticketing department for, I don't know, 20 something years. So I grew up going to the festival as a kid every year. I've been to 20 something of them. And so kind of my whole childhood, I had, you know, a mandolin. I would take lessons every now and then from Dave Lamb at the music shop there. And bluegrass was just kind of this thing that existed in my life. Mm. It was like part, but it wasn't like something that I was really like attached to in any sort of way until I discovered Yonder with a bunch of my other friends in the beginning, middle of high school, around 9th or 10th grade. And there was obviously just something so different about that.
Yeah.
And like that Saturday afternoon performance at the festival every year was like, you know, it was like church for me and my buddies. And I was lucky enough to, you know, be able to catch them like, you know, five times a weekend during that festival, and then several other times a year. I think I've probably seen Yonder Mountain String Band like 90 times.
Wow.
If I break it down in my life. So it played a huge impact. I mean, I can remember like, yeah, I mean, Half Moon Rising was a song for me that I have specific moments of memories where it was so important to me. Like driving from Cortez back to Telluride in the middle of the night, headed over Lizard Head Pass, and like seeing the moon rise over the mountains with that song playing when I was 17 years old is still a memory that is like yesterday in my mind. And I think, you know, and I got to college and I met Torin and Joe and these guys, and we went to those Yonder runs in Missoula, where we actually made most of our long lasting friends that are still our good friends today. Really just sealed the deal that it was a very special group.
And so would you guys say that sharing those experiences together and, you know, having that collective sort of fandom vibe, that was the thing that inspired you to start the band?
Yes. And I would say that plays like a huge part in the fans and the friends that we still have today. Like, I met my current girlfriend at that first Yonder show that I went to, at the after party afterwards. And she was my friend through the band for whatever, 10 years. And now we've been together for like 4 years. So, and all of our like key members of our fan group and the people that run, you know, like they're the admins on our band fan page or whatever, are people that we met at that first Yonder show. And it's so crazy.
That's heavy stuff.
And I always like, I would say that, Jeff has always been like one of my main influences, just as far as like being a front man and like, you know, just kind of commanding a crowd and giving it your energy. And I was a punk rock kid way before I ever got into bluegrass. So like the whole, you know, shredding and they do punk covers, the Misfits covers that come out and stuff like that. I was sold right away.
That's great.
Off that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know you guys need to get in to the venue here right quick to play your set, and I just want to hit really quick on Mirror Maid. These guys have a new record that has just come out, and like I said earlier, I was honored to produce and work with these guys in the studio, and I think we did a great job, team.
I
think the record came out great. Really proud of you guys. Tell me really quick, what does it represent in the progression of the band as far as songwriting, your sound, your approach to recording? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that while you can still definitely tell stylistically that these songs are written by the same people as our last album, there's definitely a growth in like just the strength and quality, whether it be subject matter, playing, or you know, all around the quality of the studio that it was done in. It was just, it was the smoothest process in the studio we could have imagined. I mean, when we did the longest song in one take. So if that's any, that's like, that's how the process went for me in my mind.
That's awesome. Well, I remember thinking that, you know, our goal was really to capture what you guys do, your sound, the way you've learned to play music together, the vibe of the band, you know, without going in and polishing it too much. And the goal was really to get in the zone and capture great live performances, great live takes, and you guys did such a great job. I thought it was awesome. So I love to hear that feels representative of the band. But what about for you, Torin? What were you proud of on this record?
I think it's just it turned out to be like a really good representation of just like the band that we are now. Our first album was like, you know, when you're, you know, like a young band and it starts out and it's kind of like a hodgepodge of all these different like recording techniques, and like, you know, we were just figuring out how to be in a studio, and also it was a bunch of material that our first guitar player had written, and so like it's not really representative of what this band is anymore. It's you know, completely different style and different material and stuff. And then the next album, our last one, Ghost in the Bottle, that we recorded with Andy Thorne, that was just us kind of figuring out how to be the band that we are now. And, you know, that was like right after Max joined the band, and we were just figuring out how to do the whole psychedelic jam grass sort of thing. And I feel like with this one, we just did a really good job of capturing just like the band that we've sort of settled into, the one that we're going to be, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think you guys did great, and I'm super proud of that record. So everyone,
me too,
check out Mirror Maid and check out the Kitchen Dwellers. These guys are an absolutely great band and a great group of dudes, and I'm really proud to have connected with them. You guys have been crushing these opening slots, and just really, really psyched to see where you guys go with your music in the future. So thanks for hanging with me today, guys.
Yeah, thanks a bunch for having us.
Great perspective right there from the Kitchen Dwellers. Thanks, guys. Make sure you give them a listen. All right, my next guest today is the incomparable John Stickley. He's a modern-day master of the acoustic guitar, and he fronts a really, really hip and unique band called the John Stickley Trio. They've got a new record coming out next spring. The first two singles are already up on Spotify, and his first record, JS3, I remember Stickley gave me a CD back in the day, and my old-school Subaru, yes, still has a CD player, and it was the only thing to spin in there for a matter of months. I'm a big fan of this guy. I love the way he approaches the acoustic guitar, and I love the sound of the band as well. When the String Dusters were in Asheville a few weeks back playing the Orange Peel, Stickley came out and jammed with us that night. But that afternoon, I got to sit down and pick his brain about everything that he's got going on, and really, really enjoyed it. So here we go, John Stickley. Hey, what's up, guys? We're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and we have a truly epic guest today. I've been a huge fan of this guy for years. He's an incredible flat picker and also a great friend. He has collaborated with the Dusters many times. He's also had a very distinguished tour of duty with the Bluegrass Generals. John Stickley, welcome to the program, my brother.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, man.
At your service.
Yeah, this is great. Stickley and I, man, we've been crossing paths forever just because of your connection to Travis, really.
Yeah.
And Broke Mountain. And Stickley is, if you ask me, an integral part of sort of the modern North Carolina bluegrass scene. We're actually coming to you today from John's home in Asheville. And his current project, the John Stickley Trio. How long have you guys been doing your thing as the trio?
It's been a while. I think the first album came out in 2010, but we were... No, 2012 was the first album. But yeah, we were messing around with it probably since, you know, 2009 or something like that. Maybe almost 10 years.
Man, I'm such a fan.
Thanks.
You guys have such an incredibly unique thing going on. Such a really great proof of concept. A great sort of distillation of all these really different influences, but you managed to really take the best of all these different genres, everything from metal to classical, of course, bluegrass, all the new acoustic sounds, and distill them into this really, really cool, really unique thing. If you guys haven't checked out the John Stickley Trio. You got to give it a listen. And you guys have a new record coming spring of 2020. And the first two singles, Animate Object and Don't Slip, are already on Spotify, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes, available now.
Cool, man. Well, we'll get back to that, and we'll definitely talk about sort of the inner workings of the JS3 and how you guys come up with your music and from conception phase all the way through recording. But I want to kind of go back to the beginning for you. I love to start these interviews with sort of an examination of the thing that really got you inspired, first and foremost, you know, the thing that got you fired up about music to where you figured out that you were going to put all your time into this thing. And then ultimately, you know, it became a career. And for you, that didn't start with bluegrass.
No, it didn't. You know, it started pretty young. I would say in church growing up was kind of my first exposure to actually like doing music, you know, following a line on a page and watching the notes move along and then being in harmony with other people and hearing how those notes go up against each other. And I remember really enjoying, you know, just reading hymns out of the hymn book, because they're for everybody. It's easy to grasp. And, you know, none of my friends really enjoyed it that much, but I was sitting there like happy, you know.
And so there's a collaboration element to it too, which is so cool. I mean, it's like making music on your own is great, but then when you start to add other voices, other instruments in, there's a synergy, 1+1=3 factor that's really cool.
Yeah, and I think that was something that hit me really early, and I was always interested in kind of leaning towards the musical side of life growing up, you know, played sports young too, but it's like there was a point there where you could either go on and do the select soccer or I actually ended up joining the North Carolina Boys Choir in elementary school. Okay. And so I did that and we toured around.
And so what was the first instrument though? Were you a drummer first? Was that the first instrument you played?
First instrument was just probably picking up my dad's guitar, learning a couple of chords on it that he showed me. So, okay. And that would be really young, probably, you know, 11, 12 years old.
Gotcha.
Something like that.
And then, but then drums in high school, right? That was your main gig?
For fun, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Played some band instruments too, sax and clarinet.
Gotcha.
For a while, then, but just kind of did everything.
And then Strunken White.
Yes.
Tell us about your
so that was kind of
early
the,
endeavors with that.
So basically when I was growing up in my neighborhood, we had a group of friends and we did two things for fun. We made movies and we made bands.
Okay.
And sometimes we made movies of our bands.
Ambitious little crew. I like it.
We made music videos. Yeah, we were like doing stuff like that. As opposed to, I don't know. I mean, we played Capture the Flag too, but we got really in, like, my parents had a camcorder. We burned through so many little mini VHS tapes on that thing. And the band just grew out of us having fun, and the music we were into at the time was kind of really influenced by the indie scene in Chapel Hill. So there was like Merge Records was blowing up, like Superchunk was getting big. There was Polvo, Spatula, Archers of Loaf, all still a lot of my favorite bands. And so we were, you know, in high school, but we could go to these cool shows that were happening in Chapel Hill. And then we started trying to kind of make music that sounded like that. And it ended up being weird, hard math rock with a real angry kind of edge to it. But, you know, I was just a happy little suburban kid. And I played drums mainly because I had a drum set. And so, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Happy suburban kids can make angry punk music too.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. Where, you know, I'm kind of drawn to, you know, aggressive music.
Okay.
And I don't know where that comes from. It's like I couldn't have had like an easier life.
what describe that like one step more. Aggressive music, the sounds, the edge, just the vibration that it has is.
I think the energy, you know, that's one thing I always come back to in music. And I think it's a big part of the music that we do, you know, in the trio is just, it doesn't even have to be high energy, but it just has to be an intense energy, you know? And I think that carries over through all styles of music. It's like my favorite bluegrass is has a very intense edge to it, whether it's the Stanley Brothers the first David Grisman Quintet album.
Sure.
Like that is some intense, very intentional, strong music.
I hear that, man. I hear that in your playing, and I feel like not only the aesthetic of the music as a whole, but within that, like stylistically, the way that you play guitar, it's the timing is just incredible.
Thanks,
and I think that's a big part of what makes the music so compelling. And I know from Maybe Believe, like there's a couple tunes, Almost You, Micro Brews, Almost With You, that's right.
Yep,
Micro Brews, I those tunes, and they're actually, they sort of remind me of, from the first record, JS3, Della's Walk.
Yeah.
It's like they have that modern bluegrass thing. There's this, the forward motion of the tune, sort of as it's weaved into the melody, like the way the melody unfolds combined with the timing, man, it's just, yeah, to me, there's this real momentum to that music, and that's sort of a hallmark of not only your playing, but also, you know, JS3, and now with Lindsay and Hunter, you guys feel like you share that aesthetic, you know, just the way that you guys approach playing your instruments. When you combine that, it just gives the music this incredible energy.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you've always been drawn to that kind of hard edge execution, just intense music.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember playing drums growing up. I mean, it just got more and more that way. I can still remember the feeling of doing it and how much of a release it is and how freeing it is to make music like that, because, you know, we're living in the world, which is very structured. At least the way I grew up was very like safe and structured and amazing. But there was something about being in the musical swirl that like you can really just completely let go and just go for it. And like, there's no boundaries at all, you know, especially when you're young and you're in a band with your friends, like you're just letting it flow. And then when I got into bluegrass eventually later, it was that same experience.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in your first bluegrass band, the bass is going, the banjo is rolling, you're slamming out rhythm guitar. It's like, it's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah. I can relate to that. You know, I wasn't working through big challenges from early on in my life, but music was this release, and where that almost, aggressive, intense energy, there might not be a place for that in the world that you or I come from. But then when you have that outlet, you know, I think people really...
Everyone needs... It's good for... No matter who you are, it's a cool thing to feel for the first time.
Yeah,
it's like addictive.
And you can get a lot out.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'll through that, and that's probably a great exercise. So,
yeah.
So now, take me through the transition into bluegrass, because you obviously your musical roots are pretty spread out. What was the thing that really drew you toward acoustic music and the bluegrass sound?
So, I guess that so I started taking guitar lessons in high school once a week. And had a really great teacher named Michael Pope in Durham, North Carolina. My brother and I took from him. And there was another kid who also was taking lessons from Michael. And he was on the lacrosse team with my brother Jeff at Githens Middle School. And his name was Andy Thorne.
Ah, yes. Andy Thorne.
And he was a guitar player who wanted to be Sam Bush on the mandolin. He was learning mandolin, and he was also trying to work his way through the Bela Fleck book on banjo. His dad had gotten him into going to Merle Fest, and he had shown him, you know, Newgrass.
Yep.
And took him to see the Nashville. He had seen that the Nashville Bluegrass Band. I was so impressed, you know.
So Thorne was the one who really sort of he opened that door for you and yeah. was kind of like, check this out. This
yes. is, and so this he's is a he thing. Him and my brother actually started playing together first. My brother was playing guitar and Andy was playing banjo. And since they knew each other, our guitar teacher hooked them up and had them, you know, playing music together duo style. And it wasn't long before I was around when they were practicing one day and Andy had his mandolin because he was doing mandolin and banjo. And he was like, here, man, take this mandolin. You can learn. The chords are easy. They're all two finger chords. Take this book and take this CD. And the CD was the original David Grisman quintet album.
Yep.
And that was the first bluegrass, newgrass. That was the first acoustic music that I had heard since I heard the Beverly Hillbillies at my grandma's house growing up.
Legendary record. The one with the instruments on
the front. Yeah. Oh, and it was like that first, you know, just the intro of EMD, I was hooked. Yeah. Like that I could have listened to EMD over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, for years.
And just real quick for a little bit of context, Andy Thorne, banjo player with Leftover Salmon. Believe it or not, I first met Thorne at the Joval Festival. Critter and I were there. This was when I was at Berkeley, so this is like, you know, mid-2000s. And Thorne and I were sort of similar-looking dudes. We had the same car, and there were multiple people who actually mistook us for each other. But Thorne has since become a great friend, one of my favorite banjo players. And when I was segueing out of the Drew Emmett Band to start the Dusters, I actually introduced Thorne to Drew and said, you know, this is your guy. He's an incredible player, incredible hang, and now he's gone on to be what I consider a really integral part of Salmon. I mean, his sound is just so perfect for them, and I know you guys go way back. This is a great backstory. So Thorne gets you into bluegrass, and then what was sort of the next, you know, how long was it before Broke Mountain actually became a thing?
So after I started learning the mandolin and playing a little bit with Andy and Jeff, our guitar teacher took us out, actually forced us to go to open mics in Carrboro, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which was a whole other scene, which was hilarious. The open mic scene back then in Chapel Hill was really off the wall, and we were exposed to a lot of weird stuff. But we started a little band. We had a band in high school called Crawdad PA. And we kind of mixed that in with, you know, in between lacrosse practice, we would go play and busk somewhere. We had a few gigs, made a little CD that we burned. And then I went off to college at NC State and kind of separated myself for a little while. And I wanted to just kind of do the college thing. And that's when I started getting to know some people in the Raleigh bluegrass scene, Russell Johnson, the Grass Cats, New Vintage, started picking
New
out
Vintage.
There.
Yeah. Julie Elkins.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, man. So I actually was in an incarnation of New Vintage for a little while. Yeah.
With Julie?
Not with Julie.
Okay.
We had played a couple gigs together, but she was doing something else by then.
Okay.
So that happened. And then Andy went to Chapel Hill for college and he met some pickers there that were what was to become the Big Fat Gap Bluegrass Band. And so I went over and jammed with them one night. And they had one of the founding members was a mandolinist. So I couldn't be the mandolin player in the band. And then they also had a lead singer, rhythm guitarist. And so that's when I tried to sell them on me playing rhythm lead guitar. I was like, I can be your lead guitar player.
Gotcha.
And so that's when I was like, okay, I need to really get better at lead guitar because I was just starting out on, you know, I could play like a couple solos by Tony Rice that I hadn't memorized.
Gotcha.
And so then we started playing shows and that was our college band was the Big Fat Gap. And I played lead guitar. And then we switched around and stuff. I played mandolin on some shows and bass and, you know, it was just bar band.
Gotcha. And North Carolina. And when I think of Big Fat Gap, I think of that as a pretty integral piece of sort of the North Carolina bluegrass scene, which I want you to tell us a little bit more about in a second, but keep tracing it for you. So Big Fat Gap, and then what was next after
yes.
that?
Yes, so Big Fat Gap is become an institution. I mean, they're getting on 20 years. Charles Humphreys has been in the band on bass from Steep Canyon for a while. Yep. You know, Joe Troop was a big part of it. He's got that band Che Apalache going now.
Okay, cool, nice.
Ryan Cavanaugh was in the band. Rex McGee. There's just we met so many. It was like a magnet for people. And it was almost like a kind of the young, energetic college vibe bluegrass band of the area.
Yeah,
so
sure.
People gravitated towards it and met all sorts of cool people. And then the end of college came, and Andy, through some friends, you know, long story short, ended up meeting some pickers in Colorado in Durango on a ski trip.
Okay.
And those people were Anders Beck, now of Green Sky Bluegrass, Travis Book of course, of the String Dusters.
Oh, yes.
And a really cool mandolin picker named Robin Davis, who's still out there. And Anders is a really good... Anders can kind of talk you into stuff. And I think Anders talked Andy into coming out. You know, Andy was going to... had one more year of school left, and he's like, hey, man... if you come out here, we can play festivals all summer long. And so Andy and Rick was actually, Rick Hawkman, our friend, was the first guitar player. And they went out to Durango that summer, and they made Broke Mountain. And I think they played like a handful of shows.
Okay.
And then at the very end, they won the Rocky Grass Band Contest.
Sure, I remember that.
And that was the spark that started Broke Mountain down the road of being a band.
Right.
And so Rick couldn't come the next summer, and that's when I stepped in and became the guitar player in Broke Mountain.
Yeah, it's great. You know, Broke Mountain, and you guys just this past summer had your first reunion show in quite a long time, right? At Telluride Bluegrass?
Yeah, it was for maybe the 15-year mark, about.
Wow.
And we did it main stage.
I mean, that band's going to go down in history, seriously, with what you guys have all gone on to do. You know, like you said, Anders and Green Sky, Travis with the Dusters, Thorn with Salmon, you're killing it with the JS3, and Robin Davis, for those of you guys who don't know, is one of the great kind of undiscovered pickers out there. I mean, he is a beast.
Total beast.
Just like the rest of you guys. And that, I know people were really hotly anticipating the reunion show at Telluride, which, how was that for you guys?
Hopefully we delivered.
How was that?
It was magical, man.
Cool.
It was amazing.
I'd love to hear that.
It was like, it was something I've been wanting to happen for so long that I had almost given up on it. You know, it's like I wanted it so bad. I wanted to do it again at the 5-year mark. Really wanted to do it again at the 10-year mark. And then after that, I was like, you know what? This might not happen. So I'm just not going to think about it much anymore. And then we got the call that it might be able to happen. And then finally we got the offer. And, I would looked forward to it for years. As soon as it was booked, it was and then we did it, and the moment flew by, but there was so much happiness and anticipation and excitement. And, I just love those guys, and we never see each other anymore, you know?
Yeah. It's, you guys are a great group of like-minded people and players, you know, great players, really solid players, but also very musically open-minded. And it's cool, man. I feel like the world can look forward to Broke Mountain reunions, you know,
all
along the way. I would hope so, too.
Yeah. But I'm going to stay in my space of, you know, hey, it may never happen again. And I'm cool with that. It happened once. So
we'll see. We'll see what Anders can convince you guys to do.
You know, he's pretty convincing.
I know. Yeah. I know. I wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit about how you practice, how you think about advancing with music, and that can be your playing, lead playing, rhythm playing, or your writing. And I should mention to our listeners that when I showed up here for the interview today, Stickley had the metronome clicking away on his iPhone on the kitchen table when I came inside. So let that be a lesson to you. Even if you have the timing of a John Stickley, who I would say is as good as they come with regard to the timing and the flow of the playing, it's still matters that you get with that metronome and you know.
Yeah, I just want to add to that, it wasn't just a click, click, click.
Show
it
us.
Was this one. That's a bass.
So it's like there's a groove.
Yeah.
It's a groove, yeah.
And it's like just a simple thing, but it's so much more fun.
Yeah, I play with a Korg drum machine that you can just like punch a simple beat into. So,
yeah.
But take us, what's like a day-to-day sort of practicing regimen for you? How do you break up your time? What do you focus on these days to improve your music?
Sometimes I wish it was better than it is. But the main things that I work on are just getting around chords, you know, working with a metronome. I play with a metronome really for fun more than anything else, because it will just keep you going. Whereas like, you know, you're playing by yourself, you start, you stop, you try different things.
Sure.
You can turn the metronome on and just flow.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my practice is just exploration, you know, figuring out different chord shapes and then, chord voicings, kind of figuring that stuff out by ear.
Now, do you ever zoom out and look at like the technique alone and iron things out, or do you take more of a, like a kill two birds with one stone, that when you're working on new musical ideas, that's kind of the best technical practice that you can do?
Pretty much working on two ideas at once.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like I'll hone in on a chord progression and then I'll like, you know, cross pick through that chord progression the whole way on the top three strings.
Sure.
You know, it's like I'm doing triads up there and really just exploratory improvisation and trying to hit different techniques. Like, you know, the different cross picking patterns are really fun for me, because it's like playing banjo, I imagine, where you've got a roll and something that's going and going and going. And that is really, that's honing in your intention, your timing, your tone in your right hand, building strength. And then left hand can just explore different chords. Say you're going to go up and we're going to play all six chords, you know, or we're going to do sevens now,
mm-hmm.
or we're going to do minors, and just kind of exploring that way, you know. And then the other thing I'm working on a lot is writing new material for the trio. So one of the ways I do that is I'll start with a beat, start with a chord progression and put a beat to that, and then, you know, kind of lay that down on the iPad and jam along and try to feel what could happen melodically, just kind of like all over the place, really.
So then with the writing thing, because that's a cool segue to sort of how you guys evolve your music in the John Stickley Trio. So you've got a seed of an idea and you take it to the band. How can that be something totally raw, totally underdeveloped, or do you bring ideas to the band a little more fleshed out?
I bring ideas pretty fleshed out.
Okay.
Like, that was a recent track we just cut for the new record, that it's almost like a performance of the demo.
Okay.
Like, I did the demo, they learned the arrangement on the demo, and we played it, and because it's them playing it, not me doing my finger drums on the iPad, and like, I usually do mandolin a lot to come up with melodies, because I know Lindsay's going to be on fiddle, so mandolin kind of gets me into that space where, okay, these are the notes we're working with.
Sure.
Sometimes I'll transpose that onto the guitar, which ends up being something I never would have really improvised on guitar, but because I came up with it on mandolin and now play it on guitar, it's kind of got a new guitar vibe to it. Just to get out of my guitar, you know,
patterns. Oh, that's such a great way to
get into all the time.
It's a great way to get new ideas flowing, sit down at a piano or any.
Yeah.
Take any different, you know, transcribe something that a horn player played, and it just gets you kind of thinking in a different way.
Yeah, so I'll get on the iPad, and I just use GarageBand, but start recording usually chords, bass lines, melodies.
So you throw together essentially a demo of the stuff that you're writing,
yes.
And that's what you take to the band. Okay.
Pretty much a fully formed demo with like, hey, the arrangement could go like this, like, you know, I'll flip flop it up and have the, you know, basically just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Like, all right, so this is a stupid idea, but I just wanted to do it to see what it sounded like. But we should definitely not do this, like, for real. And then they'll be like, well, I don't know. I kind of like that. I'm like, really? You like that? Okay, let's do it. So I'll present a fully formed demo, which they take shape a lot of times in really different ways. Like I said, I'll start with a beat, or like I'll hear a song on the radio or something that is employing some device that I think is really cool. Like a 3/4. I really like 3/4 timing.
Yeah.
Like that song Almost With You is like, dun, 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 dun. It's like a sit. Like a dun 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 dun
dun So like you have like a for the uninitiated, you have an even meter going, you know, 4/4, but then you play groups of three over it.
Yeah.
So you have the accents coming in different, but you have a syncopation basically.
Yeah, it's like you almost write the song in a 6/8, like a big swath feel like that, but then you put like a 4/4
right.
double time groove over that and everything gets all weird.
And but so then
there's a feel there.
Sure. Know? So then you guys as a band take things through an arranging process. There's going to be a solo here. There's going to be, you know, an improvisational section here. Mm-hmm. But you guys work that part out of it as a band.
Yeah. So I'll send them the demo first, and then I'll be like, all right, let's get together this day. And usually we can do. So yeah, they get the melodies in their head and like a general idea of like how the song goes, and that's when we get together and hammer it out. And sometimes it'll take, you know, a 6-hour stretch to get it to where it feels right, you know. Huh. And we'll just mess around with different, like, say, should I play rhythm guitar under this part, or should I play, like, you know, we do the thing with the bass where Lindsay and I can both do bass if we need to.
Now, speaking of that, let me just interrupt you really quick, because for those of you who haven't gone deep with the John Stickley Trio, the thing that really makes you guys unique is you don't have a bass. And it's really cool. I'm curious to know, was that a thing by design from the very beginning? We're going to have a trio, guitar, fiddle, drums, no bass. Or did you sort of take the side door into that approach, or was that the idea all along?
So the trio pretty much was done without any type of plan. It was just a project that kind of came together as a group of friends.
Okay.
As a side project for me, I was like doing other things. And it just slowly became the main thing. And we had had in the drum spot, we'd had a bass player. We had been a trio with an upright bass. Me on guitar, Lindsay on violin, and Sav Sankaran on upright bass for some early gigs.
Cool.
And then it was like something happened, and the guy who was living with me at the time, Ryan, our one of our original drummers, he like owed me some money. So he was just like, can I just come play some gigs with the band? And I was like, sure. And so that's when we did our first handful of bands with Lindsay and I and the drummer. And I just love the way it felt. I liked having a beat.
It's so different.
I never liked drums in bluegrass, but one of our first kind of mantras was that we would never do the train beat. We were anti-train beat, in the truest sense of the train beat. We do some augmentations of the train beat,
sure.
But it was like, as long as we never do the train beat, I think we'll never have that we'll never do the thing that I really never liked very much.
And the train beat is a it's like the bluegrass beat.
It's what you would hear over.
Exactly. Yeah. You hear it in country that airs more side on the bluegrass, but the bass, you know, the bass is such a fundamental aspect of most bands, and it's the tonal center. It's the thing that, you know, juxtaposed against the bass note, all these other notes make sense in a certain way by design. You know, if you're a lead player and the bass player is playing the root, and, you know, you're going off on some extensions or something sort of out there, what anchors it is the bass. But you guys managed to, well, first of all, I love the approach with the drums, because that the thing we were talking about earlier, that rhythmic edge that you guys share, that's such a big part of the sound. Like, it's just when you and Lindsay are playing melodies and you guys have a very similar time feel with the drums cranking along, no train beat. it's such a distinct, and powerful sound, but you guys managed to make really compelling music that doesn't ever lose the listeners, but with no bass. I mean, you guys have some tricks that you use an octave pedal.
Yeah. So getting back to the bass, the bassless band, not intentional, just purely random, but we ended up with that and we liked it, but not having the bass did pose certain issues. And so we started just trying to figure out how to work around those issues. And one of the first things, before we figured out how to use pedals to simulate bass, we were working with just what we had. And so that kind of forced us to play in a different way to compensate for the lack of that root tone.
Sure.
And one of the things it did was it rooted our music. Like, you had to play, you couldn't go off in Slavovia. Sure. You had to stay in it.
Because, like, you didn't have a bass anchoring that sound.
And I was having to cover the root bass note as much as possible.
Right.
So that kind of focused my whole style of playing to be a very rooted style, you know. And it's a cool experience now to play with a bass player because it's so freeing. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can completely let go.
That's exactly how I feel when I play with a drummer. You know, I mean,
you're the drummer of the String Dusters.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like we all combine, and we get this question a lot. We, you know, a big part of what we do as a band is conceive of these roles for our instruments. So we're in pre-production, and I'm saying, okay, there's this part I can play on the banjo, and these parts, you know, what I'm doing, what Falco and Travis are doing, they sort of combine to equal a drum kit.
And you're doing the same thing. You're working with lack of a mandolin.
Exactly.
Right? So everyone is easing into that role and figuring out how to drive just as hard, and you guys pull it off. Like, and it's really cool.
But it's the same thing as what you were saying. It's forced us to play first and foremost from a really musically sound place, really fundamental. That beat needs to be covered. You know, and if no one's playing the bass note, what good does it do to go explore out tonalities when you don't have anything that's making sense of those on the bottom? And it's the same thing with the rhythm, but you guys do a great job, man. You never lose the listener. There's always of course the rhythm is so solid, but it works, man. It's really cool.
And
I love it.
It's one of our goals is to keep it as relatable as possible because we know that it's an instrumental trio. Okay. And I've seen so many instrumental trios that I really like that I kind of doze off about halfway through. You know, it's just there's something there where it's like the human mind can only absorb so much, no matter how good it is.
And it loses you a little bit.
Yeah. And so as we're working through the process of figuring things out, I got a Pog bass simulator pedal.
And I use one as well.
We had a rehearsal with it, and I was like, Lindsay, you got to get one. We have to go down this road of being able to do some bass stuff because it opens up this whole, like, okay, we can get heavier now. There's a bass, because before there was bass in the mix, the drums, we were keeping them in this lighter space. And because you don't want a heavy drum groove, you know, with like dinky rhythm guitar and fiddle, it's like, it needs to be together. But now we can go low end, so it opened up a whole new world, and I like playing bass. Playing bass in the band is so much fun.
Yeah.
And Lindsay has been really fun to watch because she's a violinist, right? She never played other instruments. She started playing violin when she was 12, and she still plays the same violin.
Wow.
So for her to have to fill all these roles that are just made necessary by the limits of the band, she's had to learn a lot of chordal backup that is kind of unique to the way we play, where she's almost like providing a rhythmic background, but also getting the chord tones down where I can play, you know, over something more than just a basic fiddle chop. But then now that she's got the Pog bass simulator pedal, listening to her play bass on violin is one of the coolest things ever, because it's not a bassist's brain. It's like a violinist brain, but playing on this low register. picking out notes that a bass player would never play.
Yeah.
At least not your average bass player.
That's so cool.
And she loves it, man. It's cool to watch her do it. She's had this tingy thing up by her ear her whole life, and now she's got a low end thing.
Oh, she thrives in the band environment that you guys are creating. Her playing is so awesome, and it really fits the music, blends with your style well. And it's cool too, because when you think about ensemble playing, you know, people don't necessarily look at it this way, but with each person that you add to an ensemble, you sort of cut down some element of the live on the fly possibilities, because you have one more brain that needs to be in the fold, you know. So for example, when it's just a duo, it's like, man, the music can go absolutely anywhere. One guy or girl just has to follow the other, you know, when you're playing music. But when you have more people adding to the ensemble, you have to sort of keep them all in the fold. But with you guys, it's just a trio. And with three people, you know, you really retain a lot of those on the fly possibilities. You can go anywhere. And added to that, you have these unique sensibilities of what's Lindsay going to play, what bass line is Lindsay going to play on the fiddle, you know?
Yeah.
And so you just have...
And that's got to be... That turns into a rhythm... So the rhythm section's always kind of moving around. So when Lindsay's on bass, she's a rhythm section with the drummer. Now Hunter is grooving with Lindsay, and that's a whole other feel from when Hunter's grooving with me on bass.
Sure.
I play bass like maybe like a normal bass player a little bit more. And so then we're locked in, and it goes back and forth. So you get all these different, it's a very intimate experience. And that's something we feel a lot, is that, yeah, the trio can feel a little naked, but you add one more person. Like when we have sit-ins, we've had sit-ins on a banjo, guitar, mandolin, bass. Each one is very different, but every time we do it, we lose something. There's all of a sudden we're just like, oh, we're just kind of like doing the backup now because there's two people over there
that's
doing something.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Wow. So
you guys really do an incredible job of creating a unique sound, utilizing all the tools, bringing all these different influences. Like I hear, you know, Maybe Believe, awesome record, man. Great
Thank
job.
You.
And,
man,
you know,
awesome.
There's like, have you ever heard of an artist called BBO? B-I-B-I-O?
Nope.
Check him out. And he has this record called Silver Wilkinson that I'm a big fan of. And it's like these acoustic kind of ambient textures, like Jules, mm-hmm. Avril 14th, those two tunes really remind me of, you know, there's a production element. It's not all about a melody and the groove underneath it. It's like you guys are figuring out ways to use your instruments to create these beautiful, lush textures. And I appreciate that, man. I think it's really cool. And then you have, you know, sort of like the Jerusalem Ridge on the latest record. And then similar to kind of like Blackberry Blossom, it's like metal grass. You know, you guys just have... There's a different aesthetic. I mean, it hopefully will resonate with bluegrass people, but there's this whole other edge to it, man. It's really cool. I'm curious to know what's the new record? Tell us, like, what are you guys working on now? What's the latest iteration of the sound? What does all that look like?
So we're just kind of taking it the next step. We've got Hunter in the band now. He's coming up on his 2-year anniversary.
Yeah,
on
he
drums.
Sounds great.
Thanks. Yeah, he's the man. And he's completely added, like I said, three people. You change one person out, it's a whole new thing that we've had to kind of like grow together a lot. And so now we're working in the studio, there's this whole other element of like swirl to the mix. So Hunter's got like a very, very broad palette as far as what he can work with rhythmically. I mean, he's a classically trained jazz drummer who, you know, I'll listen to, we'll isolate the drum tracks sometimes in the studio, and I'm like, that's somebody who has spent hours and hours and hours pitter-pattering on the snare.
Right. You know? So when you say swirl, what do you mean by that?
So he's got his own flow, and it's a combination of, you know, everything he does on the drums. It's not just a beat, you know, and it's not jazz, but it's like a beat with a wash.
Yeah, sure.
And a, just a swirling
some
flow.
Some tonal textures that
and
color the beat.
And he comes up with beats that I could never have thought of, even to, like when I'm making my demos, you know, I'll put something together, but then he'll reprocess it in his brain and it will be like something completely new, which is new for us, like to have as much rhythmic input coming from him kind of has taken everything in a new direction. And the band is just, it's a unit now. So cool. It's just like, it's a breathing, growing thing. And the new album where we're working in the studio with Organic Records is it's the highest quality tones we've ever had, as far as, you know, we're mainly using mics for everything that's not like a bass effect or some delay or something like that. I mean, it's a mic'd tone, and it is capturing the best tone of our instruments that we can get. And
so it's that natural, warm,
we're going warm and natural. And Hunter's drum kit, man, it's just like, it's the same way. It just sounds like his beautiful sounding drums in a room. And that's a new step for us, because our other albums had a little bit of we did them more in a rock leaning studio, and they've got a little bit of more of an electro kind of sound.
Sure.
To them. But we really wanted to take it back and go a little more acoustic on this, and we're having fun with that.
And you had Dave King produce the last two records, but are you self-producing this new one?
Yes, we're self-producing now, and it's going great.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I can't wait to hear the new record. I'm a huge fan, man. I love what you guys got going on, and I think the band sounds better than it ever has. And I'm really so glad we got to catch up today and hang and chat, man. I can't wait to hear the new record. And you going to come down and jam with us at the Peel tonight or what?
Hell yeah.
Okay. If you guys haven't checked them out already, the John Stickley Trio will really blow your mind in every way. These guys are as good players as anyone who's out there, and they've come together to form a band that, if you ask me, is as unique and musically evocative as anything that I've heard, man. It's just a great, great vision. Great to see you guys keep forging ahead and creating new music, and look forward to jamming tonight, man. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely.
Super fun.
That's going to do it for episode 4 of Inside the Musician's Brain. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review if you feel so inclined. Inside the Musician's Brain is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Check out Osiris. There's so much more cool content there, including their latest release, After Midnight. And I want to give a real quick shout out to Backline.care. I have some great friends in the music industry who have taken the time to create a resource center for health and wellness for music industry professionals. They've poured their heart and soul into this thing. Check out Backline. Let someone know about it. It's there to help. We'll be back in 2 weeks with episode 5, which features an interview with my great friend, Jamgrass legend Bill Nershey of the String Cheese Incident. We get into all kinds of really juicy stuff. Billy was great, super honest, talking about the dynamics of the band, the influences, how they do what they do, and how they've grown to be one of the juggernauts in the jam world. Catch you in 2 weeks, guys. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11. Whoa.